from Pennsylvania to Nebraska, California to Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, after a high-profile Oval Office confrontation between President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, support for the war in Ukraine is back in the spotlight. We'll get analysis from Jake Novak of Jake's Takes. President Trump delivered a lengthy address to a joint session of Congress as the deadline for passing a new continuing resolution to keep federal spending flowing looms. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. It is known as the Jones Act, and it is driving up the cost of shipping between domestic ports. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details of a legal challenge to the act from Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And a number of states are facing multi-billion dollar deficits as profligate spending and high taxes impact their budgets. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The United States has spent billions of dollars supporting Ukraine in its effort to fight off Russian aggression. But has the time come to negotiate an end to the conflict? Jake Novak is author of Jake's Takes on Substack, and he hosts a daily morning program on Real America's Voices. He joins us now with analysis. Jake, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jake, most Americans saw the situation that occurred in the Oval Office last week between President Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky, but the president really has a strategy here. Can you talk a bit about what it is that Donald Trump is trying to accomplish?
I think there are two things that President Trump's trying to accomplish, and I think to him, they're equally important. First, he would like to see the war end between Ukraine and Russia. I don't think anyone is naive enough to think that hostilities and political rivalries between those two countries are going to end tomorrow. But the full-on fighting, the hot war, I think President Trump would like to see as soon as possible. Yes, he'd like to take credit for it, and if he's able to get it done, then why not? I mean, I don't understand why anyone would have a problem with that. That is one of the priorities. But I think just as importantly, President Trump, and this is something he's been trying to do since his first term, is trying to get the European nations, particularly the EU nations, to spend more money on their own defense. And by talking about how the United States is considering cutting off aid to Ukraine, which, of course, they've hit a pause button on it for now, that should be able to accomplish potentially both of those goals. If the Ukrainian leadership understands that they aren't going to have a continuing ATM, an unending ATM from the United States, they will be more likely to negotiate peace. And at the same time, if the EU sees the United States will be more independent about what conflicts it's going to fund in their own region, then they, too, will either decide to spend a little bit more money, which a lot of the countries at least pledged to do. Whether they actually do it or not, we'll see. But a number of countries, most notably the United Kingdom, pledged to spend more money in the defense of Ukraine, which, of course, is indirectly defending their own continent. This is what Donald Trump wanted. This will either force them to do that or force them to take on a policy where they are less confrontational and make more decisions that make more sense for the security of their own continent. So I think both of those things are what Donald Trump is really trying to accomplish. And by getting tough on Ukraine funding, it looks like there's a chance for both of them to happen. It may not happen overnight or as quickly as the president wants, but we certainly saw a movement on both sides this week alone. So that I think was encouraging.
What role does the proposed agreement on the rare earth minerals play in all of this?
Well, it plays a very important role, one that most of the news media is completely missing. Russia wants those rare earths. So does China. And that is there's been a carrot and a stick approach to Russia in this Trump administration. The carrot has been to put more pressure on Ukraine, to try to walk back the demonization of Putin completely, to make it clear that the United States, or at least the Trump administration, believes that Ukraine has some complicity in this war. Now, that's the carrot. The stick has been that the United States is making it clear that we're going to take those rare earths, whether we pay for it or not, whether we make a long-term deal for it or not. And that is a major, major blow to Russia, because Russia, that's one of the biggest reasons why they want to take tactical control over Ukraine. And it's not being covered very much by the mainstream news media, because the mainstream news media, their only narrative they have pursued between President Trump and Vladimir Putin since 2016, really 9 years now, has been to try to push this idea that President Trump is somehow Putin's puppet and doing everything to help Vladimir Putin. There's been a lot of things that for under the first Trump administration and now with this rare earth deal that the Trump administration has done that is very much flying in the face of what Russia wants. And it's very much a hindrance to Vladimir Putin's overall agenda. And it's important that it's really regrettable that the mainstream news media is missing this part of the story because it's making it sound like everything's going Russia's way. And that might encourage Russia to also dig their heels in a little bit too much. The world needs to know, including people in Russia, including the other oligarchs that are in line with Putin, but at some point in time will have to decide how to replace him when he passes away or could pressure him to step down. They need to understand and be reminded that the American people know that the Trump administration isn't doing everything Vladimir Putin wants. And as long as most of the mainstream news media misses this angle, then the carrot and stick approach isn't going to work as well as it could. So this is a real abrogation of responsibility by most of the mainstream news media. They should be reporting about how this rare earth deal is a huge blow to Vladimir Putin, and they should be doing that regularly.
The hundreds of billions of dollars that the United States has poured into this effort, is it important that we get some of that money back?
Well, of course it is. This is a huge problem for a country that we're approaching a $40 trillion debt. Now, how to get that money back? It can't all come from Ukraine. They don't have that. And obviously, this rare earth deal, I think, is maybe $500 million, maybe at best. I think it's worth a lot more than that in political capital, but that's not going to be enough to recoup the spending. But that is where the spending by the other European countries on their own defense comes in. If this entire event, entire fiasco, whatever you want to call it, ends up leading to a world where the Europeans spend more for their defense, even though it may not, again, lead up to that final price tag that the American taxpayers had forked over to Ukraine, it could be worth still many billions of dollars, but even more valuable than that, it could lead to less risks for world war, less risks for new conflicts like this to start in the first place, and in some ways be worth a lot more than a few $100 billion, because this could lead to a lot less of a stretching of the American defense capabilities, a lot fewer political problems, and a lot fewer problems for NATO and the strain on that alliance. So let's say it's a couple $100 billion, but we only end up getting $1 billion here or there, but hundreds of billions of dollars in the future that we won't be spending on a similar problem like this, that's where the savings can come in.
We have been talking with Jake Novak. He has Jake's Takes on Substack. So Jake, tell us a bit about that, and you have a new venture as well.
Yes, on Substack, I put out a couple of updates, news updates every day, short ones, about 2 or 3 minutes each that you can listen to, get up to date on all the general news and the financial news, by the way, very basic financial news. But I am also the host of my own program on Real America's Voice. It's a cable station that you can also see on all the streaming networks. You can watch it online. You can watch it on X. And that is called American Sunrise Early Edition, and that is on from 7 to 8 a.m. every Monday through Friday. And I anchor and produce that show. We have great guests and we have great topics.
So you get an early start each day. Jake Novak of Jake's Takes. And also you can see him on Real American Voices. So Jake, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. It has been, to say the least, a very busy week in Washington, D.C. The agenda going forward also very full. We're going to cover a number of topics today with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
President Donald Trump addressed a joint session of Congress. It wasn't exactly a State of the Union speech, but a joint session of Congress this past week. It was a two-hour performance. What did you think?
For all intents and purposes, it's very similar to a State of the Union, but a president does not have a State of the Union speech in their first year in office. And obviously, this is his fifth year in office, but he knows what he's doing. He's got the experience addressing Congress before. And this week, we had a lone survivor of Doug Collins, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. We had most of the Supreme Court there, most of the House and Senate Republicans. Some Democrats decided to protest the speech by not showing up. Some Democrats decided to walk out on the speech. And Al Green of Texas even decided to raise his cane and get thrown out by the sergeant-at-arms after disrupting the speech several times in a row. But I think the big takeaway here from President Trump is that we're getting the country back on track. Our national security has been fixed. And he's making a lot of changes right now through executive actions and orders. And we expect our House and Senate majorities in Congress to get to work and really enact the America First Trump agenda that, you know, serves as the electoral mandate that delivered those majorities. This was basically a gaslighting performance, I think, by the Democrats, where they had basically bingo cards that said, you know, protect Medicaid and, you know, this is false and this is not normal and all these signs of protests. But, you know, they can't even stand up and you know, clap for a brain cancer survivor, a child named DJ Daniel, who received a badge from the Secret Service director to be an honorary Secret Service agent. And, you know, just kind of a heartwarming story for those of us that watched the speech. He also had tributes to Jocelyn Nungery's family and Corey Contempitore's family. He was the victim of the Trump assassination attempt that tragically lost his life in Butler County, Pennsylvania.
So it was a spectacular night for Donald Trump, but sadly, we lost a member of Congress either during or shortly after the speech.
Yeah, Sylvester Turner was a freshman U.S. representative, a Democrat from the Houston area. He's a former mayor of Houston. He represented the 18th congressional district there, and he had a medical emergency at his offices. Had been posting video earlier in the night along with his joint session guests saying that he wanted to protect Medicaid and sort of, you know, putting things out that he was pretty healthy and obviously suffered an emergency and unfortunately passed away on late Tuesday evening. So, you know, it creates an interesting dynamic actually in the House of Representatives because House seats are not appointed. You have to fill those through a special election. And despite the fact that Elise Stefanik was nominated, I think in November, to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, you know, Kathy Hochul over there in New York has refused to schedule a date for the 21st District of New York. And so now we have a couple of vacancies where, you know, you have a Republican governor in Texas with Governor Abbott, and he gets to decide the date of when this Texas special election is going to occur. And then you have a Democrat governor in New York who's going to decide when the special election to fill that Republican seat is going to occur. Meanwhile, the House currently stands at 218 to 214. We've got two more Florida districts that are going to be filled on the general special election of April 1st. So we'll have some reserves coming in here, I guess, pretty quickly from Florida to help us along with the tax bill. But we've got a lot of work ahead of us, including a big continuing resolution next week on March 14th.
That continuing resolution, as you just stated, it's just days away that the continuing resolution expires. Where does renewal of the CR stand? Of course, the thought of getting an actual budget is a bit of a fantasy, but another CR?
I think it will be another CR. You know, the question is, what do the Democrats do to try to obstruct? And Republicans are rallying around President Trump right now. President Trump has called for a clean continuing resolution to September 30th. And, you know, that effort would effectively maintain current levels of spending, which are at the so-called Fiscal Responsibility Act spending levels. And it would extend it all the way to the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. The issue here is that you still need 7 Democrats in the United States Senate to go along with this plan to avoid a filibuster and to invoke cloture to basically proceed to final passage in the U.S. Senate. It's unclear exactly what the Democrats are going to do. They've said that they basically want to neuter the ability of Doge and Elon Musk. That's a non-starter for President Trump and congressional Republicans. What we're going to do is we're going to pass this continuing resolution, a clean one, at current levels that basically continues everything that we've been doing over the last year, including underneath President Biden. And, you know, the Democrats are going to face a really difficult decision on whether they're willing to shut down the government. You know, a lot of the times the Republicans get the finger pointed at them and get blamed for shutting down the government because they want to change this or that on the continuing resolution of the spending bill. You remember the Obamacare shutdown that Ted Cruz helped spearhead way back in 2013, 2014. You know, this is a situation here that the Democrats, I think, don't hold a lot of cards. And we obviously hold both chambers in terms of our majorities. And I'm looking forward for Republican unity to move forward so that we can actually get back to a regular order appropriations process, which would begin in May, where you'll see Congress adjudicate individual appropriation bills and actually exert its power of the purse, sending bills over to President Trump to be signed into law.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, we are based out of Washington, D.C. We're an economic organization that's united in this idea of freedom, opportunity, and liberty. We have over 525,000 members. You, a listener of Loman Henry's radio show, can actually sign up and become a member for free by visiting clubforgrowth.org.
Hey, we get to give away free stuff on this radio show. Scott Parkinson, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
An antiquated law is driving up the cost of shipping goods between American ports. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation.
So I consider myself to be someone who knows a fair bit about the U.S. Constitution. And if you're listening to this show, then I imagine that you are probably at least somewhat familiar with it, too. So let me tell you, there's few things more exciting. And I know this makes me a nerd, but there's few things more exciting than learning about a new little wrinkle, a new little detail that the founders put in there that I'd never heard of before, never come across before. And it's even better when that little detail, that little wrinkle is something that might be able to take down what I think is a seriously flawed and broken law. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about this interesting little constitutional wrinkle that they are going to use to challenge the constitutionality of the Jones Act. We'll get into all that in just a second. Let's bring him on the show here first. Josh, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on.
I really want to get into the cool constitutional stuff here, but we got to start with the basics. You guys have filed a lawsuit this week challenging the constitutionality of the Jones Act. I imagine at least some of our listeners have never heard of that law before. So what is the Jones Act?
The Jones Act was passed just after World War I, and it was designed to strengthen the U.S. military capabilities, national security, and maritime capabilities. It purported to do this by requiring that all shipping between American ports be done by ships that are owned and crewed and flagged as American. That maybe doesn't sound too bad, but over a century later, the law has proven to be a catastrophe. Despite its lofty goals, the Jones Act has significantly increased the cost of domestic shipping, stifled competition, created inefficiencies, and even weakened the maritime industry itself, despite reporting to protect it. We have fewer ships than we had before. We have fewer mariners than we had before. And shipping is more expensive than it was before. And that's all due to the Jones Act.
Yeah, the Jones Act honestly just drives me crazy because the lack of competition in shipping means, you know, just to kind of put a fine point on this, it's a lot cheaper to ship something from Los Angeles to Australia than it is from Los Angeles to Hawaii, even though that's a lot closer because there's not as many ships that can do it. So obviously the ships that are allowed to do it can charge a lot more. And this is important. I mentioned Hawaii because your client in this case is somebody on the Hawaiian Islands who thinks they're being treated unfairly by the law.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So our client is a rum producer and seller. They like to ship their rum to the mainland so people on the mainland can enjoy their unique flavors. But unfortunately, it's very expensive to ship from Hawaii to Los Angeles. It's actually a lot more expensive to ship from Hawaii to Los Angeles than to ship from Hawaii to Asia or Australia or any of these other many other far-flung places, despite them being much longer routes. And again, that's because of the Jones Act. There's only two shippers available to Hawaiian businesses, and they can't use foreign flag vessels to get their products to the mainland.
Yeah, it's the same story as always with protectionism. If you limit competition, you drive up prices, that's what happens. The Jones Act is an economic failure. Maybe it's a constitutional failure too. We're talking with Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about their new lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Jones Act. And Josh, this is the part that's really exciting for constitution nerds like me, because you guys have dug into Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution and pulled out something called the Port Preference Clause, which I've never heard of before, but it's been there for nearly 250 years. What does that mean, and how is that relevant to all this?
Sure. So I can't really blame you for not being familiar with it. It's a little used clause in the Constitution. And on top of that, it's fairly obscure. I hadn't even heard of it myself until we started looking into this issue. And so basically it says that the United States can't pass a law that discriminates against a state's ports in favor of another state's ports. And so in this case, we're talking about Hawaii. Hawaii does not have access to alternative shipping options like mainland states do. They can't ship their goods to Los Angeles on the back of a long-haul truck. They can't use rails. They can't use any sort of alternative shipping. And so they're stuck with Jones Act compliant shipping options, which puts them at a huge disadvantage whenever it comes to competing with mainland businesses or even foreign businesses. At the time that the Jones Act was passed, Hawaii wasn't even a state. And so one of the explicit purposes from the sponsors of the bill was to discriminate against Hawaiian and Alaskan shipping in favor of mainland shipping. So in other words, Hawaii and Alaska would subsidize the shipping for mainland states. And so because the Jones Act imposes this discriminatory effect, we think that the Port Preference Clause can be used to attack it.
Okay, so I mean, I can imagine historically the reason that clause is in there is because, you know, in the 1780s, there would have been all sorts of concerns about, like, well, the federal government could pass a law that preferences the Port of Boston over the Port of New York or over the Port of Charleston, something like that. The framers wanted to keep the federal government from being able to put its thumb on the scale of those kind of local economies. But now here, this is what's really cool is that that's there. You guys can pull it out and use it to at least make the courts consider this question of you know, whether this law unfairly preferences certain ports over others. It seems to me like it does. There's a really interesting angle here. Give me a sense going forward now of what happens next. This is obviously just at the very beginning of things here, but where are you hoping to get with this?
We are hoping that we can take down the cabotage provisions. So those are the provisions that require basically the main problem with the Jones Act, which is requiring that all ships shipping goods between ports in America be flagged, owned, and crewed by Americans. We're hoping to get those struck down, at least as applied to the non-contiguous states like Alaska and Hawaii. And so we filed the case in federal court in D.C. This is we're in the very early stages here, but that's what we're ultimately hoping to achieve.
And PLF, of course, has a pretty terrific track record of getting cases in front of the Supreme Court. So fingers crossed that we'll see this one. Maybe it doesn't even have to go that far. Who knows? But we'll certainly see the courts have to weigh in on this, you know, for the first time. And that is always exciting and interesting. Josh, we are out of time for today, but thanks for walking us through all this.
Okay. Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you.
And once again, that is Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Check out their work online on this case and lots of other fascinating stuff at pacificlegal.org. Find our coverage of this lawsuit as well at reason.com. You can check out the piece I wrote this week. Is the Jones Act unconstitutional? That is the question that the courts will be asked thanks to this lawsuit. Check that out there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Maryland and several other states are facing budget deficits after years of overspending. We learn more from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As Washington, D.C. hums with debate over extending the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, the Trump tax cuts, and slashing wasteful spending through the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, we have an incredible opportunity to rethink the size and scope of the federal government in the lives of everyday Americans. Meanwhile, the states lay bare the choices: fiscal discipline paired with tax relief, or reckless spending capped by tax hikes. The results aren't random. Economics rewards the prudent and punishes the profligate. Look at Maryland, where Governor Wes Moore and the legislature face a $3 billion deficit, a self-inflicted wound from overspending after years of budget surpluses under Republican Governor Larry Hogan. Their remedy? Tax increases. Moore wants to hike the top income tax rate, which, with local taxes included, could reach a whopping 9.7%, near the nation's highest. He's also pushing a 2.5% tax on business services and so-called combined reporting, forcing businesses to report nationwide earnings to Maryland's tax men. This isn't clever. It's a stick-up. Businesses and workers don't wait around to be fleeced. They leave. Maryland's competitiveness fades, and its budget gap widens as taxpayers vanish. On the left coast, Washington State confronts a $16 billion shortfall over 4 years. A 2022 capital gains tax was pitched as a fix. Instead, it drove wealth out. Jeff Bezos fled to tax-free Florida, saving $1 billion in the process. Washington once knew better. Post-2001 recession, Governor Gary Locke tackled a $2.4 billion deficit without tax hikes, cutting waste and sharpening priorities. Now Governor Jay Inslee peddles a wealth tax and business levies. A state that boomed with opportunity now leaks residents. Its policy has become a masterclass in decline, unfortunately. Elsewhere, states like Maine and New Jersey lean on excise taxes on firearms, tobacco, alcohol, gaming to patch budgets. One particularly concerning example comes from the Buckeye State, where Ohio's Governor Mike DeWine wants to double the sports betting tax from 20 to 40%. Jumping from 10 to 40% taxes is not a strategy. It's government greed, plain and simple. People duck these taxes by betting in unregulated markets offshore, cutting back, or bolting. Revenue stays shaky, but the mirage persists. And this time, the tax increase is sold to help Cleveland pay for a new football stadium. Well, taking a step back just for a minute, real conversations need to be had around the idea of governments, read that, taxpayers, fund professional sports stadiums owned by billionaire owners in the first place. That needs to be a real conversation before taxpayers are asked to pay more. Contrast this with states choosing common sense over expedience. Louisiana, in December, ditched its progressive income tax for a flat 3% rate. This flat tax revolution is a story that needs to be told and retold, since the Washington, D.C. media is more fixated on the gossip of the day versus real tax reforms that impact millions of hardworking taxpayers across the country. One of the flat tax states, Idaho, just this week shaved its flat tax again by nearly a half a percentage point, proving reform can build momentum. Kentucky's flat tax fell to 3.5% last month. Lower taxes spark growth, not grievance. All told, more than half of the states have substantially reduced personal income taxes since 2021. Governors across the nation are calling for income tax cuts to hone their state's economic competitiveness. This isn't altruism at the end of the day. It's calculation. States that lighten loads on taxes draw talent and investment. The pattern is clear. Tax-cutting states versus tax-hiking states provide us an incredible laboratories of democracy idea for what Washington can learn from the states. You have the tax-hiking states like Maryland, Illinois, and New Jersey, for instance, watch economic life ebb as Americans vote with their feet, chasing freer ground. Punish earners and firms, and you'll get less of each. Couple that with the fiscal folly and the spiral tightens. More taxes chase dwindling taxpayers. Tax-cutting states, however, see the reverse. Growth in in-migration. People work for themselves, not bureaucracies. Washington, D.C.'s wrangling over the 2017 tax cuts and the huge debate that revolves echoes this split between the states. States raising taxes sound a warning. Competitiveness dies. Deficits linger. Economics isn't guesswork. Incentives drive behavior. And when government takes less, people produce more. For more information on this and many other topics, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WEJZ-FM and WGNE-FM in Jacksonville, Florida, along with WSOK-AM in Arkansas City, Kansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.